Welcome to Change Surfer Radio. I'm Dr. J. For the next half hour, keep your mind open and your radio tuned to the left as we present a sexy high-tech vision of a radically democratic future.
Yes, welcome, comrades. This is the News of the Future edition of Change Surfer Radio. Today we'll be talking, reading a series of articles that I think will amuse and stimulate your thinking. And I want to start with a piece by Barbara Ehrenreich, who's a close ally, friend of some years past. We haven't seen each other in a while, but Barbara and I used to see each other quite often at various political events. And she is just a fabulous writer if you haven't read her stuff. This is a piece from the June 6th LA Times called Longevity Crisis, Kill Grandma. And she starts it, "A specter is stalking the Western world, and it looks a lot like Grandma. As President Bush has repeatedly put it, the problem with Social Security is that baby boomers will be living longer. Not too long, he's careful to say, but long enough to create a fiscal catastrophe. And it's not just Social Security. Medicare, as well as any company rash enough to have offered pensions, may eventually sink under the weight of its obligations to the elderly. A welfare state designed in the era of bacon, eggs, and lucky strikes cannot expect to survive in an age of active seniors who wash down their Viagra with soy milk and think a six-pack is something you get at the gym. So far, the policymakers' response has been to cut the welfare state before the greedy geezers can plunder it. For example, the Bush administration has achieved deep cuts in Medicaid, which supports many of the middle class in their post-golden nursing home years, and it continues to fight for the evisceration of Social Security. But can such namby-pamby solutions really get to the root of the problem? Isn't it clear that there are just too many old people around luxuriating in their assisted living communities and expecting the government to support their statin and beta blocker habits? Does no one have the courage to confront the longevity crisis head on? There are exceptions, a few Americans brave enough to try. Some credit should go to Burger King for its new enormous omelet sandwich and to Hardee's for its monster burger to 1/3-pound patties. Nor can we expect the neglect the manufacturers of the various cardiovascularly compromising painkillers, such as Celebrex and Vioxx. In addition, Wythe, the pharmaceutical company whose aggressively marketed hormone replacement therapy pill turned out to cause breast cancer and heart disease, deserves some retrospective recognition. The longevity-fighting Purple Heart, though, goes to the Center for Consumer Freedom, funded by the tobacco and restaurant industries, which bravely battles restrictions on indoor smoking, repressive limits on blood alcohol levels for drivers, and the relentless liberal badmouthing of salt, fat, sugar, and meat. And what has the CCF gotten for its efforts? A challenge to its tax-exempt status from the Citizens for Responsibility and Ethics in Washington. Face it, nothing is really going to change until the federal government tackles the problem itself. It might start drafting 60-year-olds, for example, for a few months of service in the Iraqi desert. And what about transforming the Drug Enforcement Administration into the Diet Enforcement Administration with the power to search drivers for stray bits of broccoli and tofu? Of course, it could be argued that Bush's attack on the welfare state will solve the longevity crisis without recourse to controversial measures. Toss Gramps out of the nursing home, take away his Social Security check, and see how long he survives. Still, it's fair to ask, is Bush really doing enough? Or is he being held back by his oft-stated commitment to the culture of life? Here's the contradiction in the tiny dark heart of American conservatism. Its values are solidly pro-life, but its economic policies lean toward death. While upholding the right of each stem cell to blossom into a human, conservatives have curtailed the lives of all multicellular citizens by weakening environmental regulations, for instance, and cutting social programs. Right-wing ambivalence on life and death issues exploded into a schizophrenic breakdown in the case of Terri Schiavo. With one hand, the Republicans held her feeding tube firmly in place, while with the other hand, they reached for the axe to cut off the flow of Medicaid dollars that were keeping that poor shell of a woman alive. It would take courage for a president to promote a consistently pro-death outlook. Some Christian spokesmen will fret that we are on the slippery slope to euthanasia, although they have never complained about torture or war. Nevertheless, it might be tactful to frame the new stance as a way of encouraging turnover, as at Walmart, where 40% of employees leave every year, rather than death. get born, get into the crucial 18 to 35-year-old consumer demographic, and have the good sense to get out before you've overstayed your welcome. And it would take genuine heroism to confront baby boomers with the question usually addressed to 18-year-old grunts. Are you willing to die for your country? Like maybe right now? Because that's what they want from us, folks, unless we come up with a better idea. That was Barbara Ehrenreich, Longevity Crisis, Kill Grandma, in the June 6th LA Times. Here's a little science piece. I'm not going to read the whole thing. It's from U.S. News and World Report, but it's about an interesting bit of sociobiological research, which turns out to support the notion that there is a fundamental drive in us to encourage pro-social behavior. And this is a piece, Why We Need Nosy Parkers, Busybodies, It Turns Out, May Help Us Coexist, by Tom Hayden. And this is the June 13th issue of the U.S. News and World Report. We all know the type, the goody two-shoes, chasing a litter bug for a block to return an errant chip bag, the teacher's pet, smugly ratting out note passers in class, the self-appointed etiquette cop, quick with a rebuke for line jumpers, crying children, and public cell phone talkers everywhere. Uptight? Quite possibly. Annoying? Almost certainly. But the urge to call attention to others' infractions is more common than we like to admit. And researchers are finding the moralists among us might be an essential ingredient in the glue that holds human societies together. Social scientists call the behavior altruistic punishment, the willingness to step in and enforce societal norms, even if doing so carries little chance of reward and significant personal cost. Psychological theories and economic models suggest that people should make decisions about how to behave in groups based on their own best interests, rather than the good of the group. In other words, taking an inconsiderate clod to task for butting into line in front of you makes perfect sense. But how to explain the person who bawls out a stranger for butting into line behind them? And yet the altruistic punishment impulse comes up time and again in daily life and psychology experiments. Take this classic trust game. You give a group of people some money, $20 say, and a set of rules. Players can contribute any amount to the common pool with the promise of a modest return, or they can free ride, pocketing their initial stake plus a share in the group profits. If all the players cooperate fully, everyone comes out ahead, but if one player acts selfishly, he'll do even better. You don't have to be a psychologist to guess how soon the whole system breaks down. Allow honest players to punish cheaters with a fine, however, and most will jump at the chance, even if doing so costs a significant portion of their profits. The tendency to punish free riders is very confusing, says James Fowler, a political scientist at the University of California, Davis, because there are only a few punishers. If there are only a few punishers, the cost is very high. The impulse to punish cheating and other selfish behavior appears to be deep-seated. When a group of Swiss researchers used brain scans during similar common goods games, they found that the decision to punish cheaters stimulated the dorsal striatum, a brain region associated with processing rewards. We saw one of the key reward areas of the brain was activated when players had the option to punish others for unfair behavior, said Ernst Fehr, an economist at the University of Zurich. In other words, people choose to punish inconsiderate behavior not for personal gain, but because it feels good. Discipline and punish. Still, says Fowler, the system only works if there are plenty of punishers to enforce, which begs the question, how does the behavior arise in the first place? In a computer simulation published recently in the journal Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, Fowler shows that the key is to allow people to opt out of the exercise completely, foregoing both contributions and benefits. If even one or two punishers tip the balance towards mutually beneficial behavior, more people will decide to join the group, sharing costs and benefits, perhaps even becoming punishers themselves to protect their investment. So that is a classic explanation for not only the kind of genetic roots of cooperation in our society, but also for why we need things like the kind of animosity that you see in a strike when people yell at scabs and attempt to punish them for acting in a selfish way in that situation. It's not always pretty. Class struggle is never pretty, but it's sometimes quite necessary. Here's another one. Speaking of collective behavior, this one I thought was just fascinating, and it riffs off of actually Barbara Ehrenreich's comment about we multicellular organisms versus the embryos and the single-cell organisms. This is a recent press release, June 9th press release from the Wellcome Trust Sanger Institute, titled "The Constitution of a New Model Army, Genome Basis of Working Together for a Common Good." And actually this you know, they talk about the army in the title, but actually it sounds more like democracy is what they're talking about. But you can decide here. It says, democratic elections are the times when the actions of the majority form the basis for the future of the whole. Individual citizens gather together to take part in deciding how they will all live. On Thursday, 5th of May, 2005, the biological constitution of a remarkable organism that votes with its feet was published in Nature by a team of scientists from the UK, USA, Germany, Japan, and France. The Dictyostelium discoideum, known as Dicty to researchers, spends most of its time living alone in the soil as a single-celled amoeba. However, in a food shortage, the individual cells talk to each other, aggregate, and then develop into a multicellular organism that produces spores, the only survivors of the time of hunger. This unique and seemingly simple development has helped biologists understand how, for example, cells in the human immune system communicate and how that process can go wrong in disease. It's even being used to try to understand the development of bipolar disorder. Paul Deer, a lead scientist from the MRC Laboratory of Molecular Biology at Cambridge, said, were it not for its tiny size and the unwieldy name, Dictyostelium would be familiar to all of us as one of the most bizarre forms of life on Earth. It represents a branch of life that we know parted company from animals shortly after plants or animals went their separate ways. Its DNA sequence, now an open book for researchers worldwide, shares genes with plants, animals, and fungi, and promises to shed light on many fundamental aspects of biology. As a single cell, Dicty is ideal for mutation, the first choice from the geneticist's toolbox, and many of its biochemical processes have been modified, revealing the underlying circuitry of life. But its development from a single cell to true multicellular organism makes it more valuable as a model. So isn't that fascinating, you know, that not only are we finding that we have deep in our own genes neurological genetic basis for us to cooperate as a species, for us to punish people who don't want to cooperate and who want to act selfishly. But we also find that all the way back to the origins of multicellular life, that there is this tendency towards aggregation into multicellular condition. And this, I think, is a very important point whenever you go and argue with one of these market fundamentalists who want to argue that human beings are trying to do something so unnatural when we try to regulate or plan in the market, and that we should just allow markets to do whatever they want because markets, individual, free individuals trading without ever having any kind of government to direct their behavior is the only way that things will actually work well. Well, here we see that with these amoebas, they don't stay in their little pits and you know trade or something. They actually get together, form a government, launch their spores, and survive as a species. And of course, that's what we have to do as well. Okay, let's move on to yet another indication of a fundamental biological organism. Again, Ernst Fehr is central to this, you'll see, but a fundamental biological organism involved in social cooperation. And this was some fascinating research released on June 2nd. This is from an AP story Joseph Verengia wrote. Swiss and American scientists demonstrate in new experiments how a squirt of the hormone oxytocin stimulates trusting behavior in humans, and they acknowledge that the possibility of abuse can't be ignored. Of course, this finding could be misused, said Ernst Fehr of the University of Zurich, the senior researcher in the study, which appears in Thursday's issue of the journal Nature. I don't think we currently have such abuses. However, in the future, it could happen. Other scientists say that the new research raises important questions about oxytocin's potential as a therapy for conditions like autism, in which trust is diminished. Or perhaps the hormone's activity could be reduced to treat more rare diseases like Williams disease, in which children approach strangers fearlessly. Might their high level of trust be due to excessive oxytocin release, said University of Iowa neurologist Antonio Damasio, who reviewed the experiments for Nature. Little is known about the neurobiology of trust, although the phenomenon is beginning to attract attention. Oxytocin is secreted in the brain tissue and synthesized by the hypothalamus. This small but crucial feature, located deep in the brain, controls biological reactions like hunger, thirst, and body temperature, as well as visceral fight-or-flight reactions associated with powerful basic emotions like fear and anger. For years, oxytocin was considered a straightforward reproductive hormone found in both sexes. In both humans and animals, this chemical messenger stimulates uterine contractions and labor and induces milk production. In both men and women, oxytocin is released during sex. Then, elevated concentrations of the hormone were also found in cerebrospinal fluid during and after birth, and experiments show that it was involved in the biochemistry of attachment. It's a sensible conclusion, given that the babies require years of care and the body needs to motivate mothers for the demanding task of childbearing. In recent years, scientists have wondered whether oxytocin also is generally involved with other aspects of bonding behavior, specifically whether it stimulates trust. Trust is the glue of society and human interactions. Erase it and you compromise everything from love to trade and political order. And by the way, I think this is one of the reasons why people so often get screwed up in email communication as opposed to face-to-face communication, because it's so difficult to establish trust. But at any rate, the experiments that Fuhrer used to establish that oxytocin played a role in trust were some of these games. He had students work together in various games, and he dosed some of them with oxytocin, others not with oxytocin. And the ones in the who were dosed with oxytocin were much more trusting in their gaming behavior. And so it's made a lot of people question whether you might have to have an oxytocin tester when you go in to buy a used car or when you go into a negotiation for nuclear weapons control or something like that. Okay, now this is a little bit self-indulgent, but John Horgan is a science writer for the Scientific American. And about 10 years ago, he wrote a book called The End of Science, where he argued that there was nothing more interesting to be discovered in science and that we were just on a downhill slope into complacency. It was kind of like the end of ideology thesis of Francis Fukuyama, who argued that we had discovered liberal democracy. Liberal democracy was the end of all political evolution. Nobody had to think about anything new after that. Well, Francis Fukuyama doesn't believe that anymore. And apparently John Horgan has recently discovered in my work and other people's work that there may be some new ways of thinking about the future that are equally utopian, and thinking about science that is equally utopian and farsighted, and that there may be new things to discover. So here's his piece in the Chronicle of Higher Education, which is about the snarkiest, includes about the snarkiest review of my book that I've seen yet. But his piece is called Brain Chips and Other Dreams of the Cyber Evangelists. It's in the June 3rd issue of the Chronicle of Higher Education. At times, I confess, I yearn for a brain chip, dissatisfied with the sluggish, aging, 3-pound lump of neurons that nature bequeathed me. I fantasize that a surgeon has drilled a hole in my cranium and installed a neuromorphic adaptive quantum nanoprocessor in my cortex. Its features would include a Wi-Fi internet link-up and an artificial pundit program customized to reflect my rhetorical and intellectual idiosyncrasies. Instead of agonizing over this essay, I'd let my brain chip do the work. I'd mentally specify the essay's topic, target audience, word count and tone, settings mildly skeptical to viciously snarky. My brain chip would scour cyberspace for relevant readings, distill the mass of data and opinion into a nifty 2,000-word essay, and beam it to my editor, all in less than, well, the time it takes my real self to type this period. I could finally make a decent living as a freelancer. Brain chips are only one of the many technologies that allow us to transcend our natural limits, but they appeal to those who consider genetic or pharmaceutical enhancement too subtle and too slow. Think of the difference between the films Gattaca, whose genetically souped-up characters resembled supermodels with high IQs, and The Matrix, in which everyone sported brain jacks. Brain chips would, in principle, allow us to download digitized knowledge of kung fu or helicopter navigation directly into our memory banks, like characters in The Matrix. We could also control our computers and toaster ovens with our thoughts, communicate with other chip-equipped people, not in our current tedious one-word-at-a-time fashion, but broadband, and exchange virtual sex fluids with talented sex bots. Such sci-fi scenarios are imminent, if we are to believe recent books like Digital People, Citizen Cyborg, iCyborg, and Flesh and Machines. The tone of the books varies from sober to silly, but their perspectives overlap enough to form a distinct genre, which we might call cyber evangelism. The basic theme is that science is on the verge of bringing about an astounding merger of machine and man. I say man advisedly. All the authors are men, and their infatuation with technology has a male cast. The major disagreement among the authors concerns how far we will go in embracing what Sidney Perkowitz, a physicist at Emory University, calls neurobionics in Digital People. Some cyber evangelists believe that we will eventually abandon our flesh and blood selves and become entirely artificial, like Hollywood starlets, but more so. Not everyone is thrilled by the prospect of cyborgs. Those fuddy-duddies on President Bush's Council on Bioethics have fretted that the capacity to download textbooks into the human brain could undermine students' work ethic. Oh, the horror. What if someone hacks into your brain box, into your brain chip to read your thoughts, or to control you, as in the recent remake of The Manchurian Candidate? And won't neurobionics deepen the gap between haves and have-nots? James Hughes, a bioethicist at Trinity College in Hartford, nonetheless contends that the benefits of neurobionics far outweigh the risks. We could minimize potential problems, he argues in Citizen Cyborg, by establishing a benign world government that made brain chips available to everyone and regulated their use. To ensure that cyborgs behaved, for example, the government would test them for moral decency. Those who failed would have morality chips installed. Hughes is the executive director of the World Transhumanist Association, whose members favor transcendence of our biological limits. Transhumanists enjoy debating issues like cryonic preservation. After you die, should you have your whole body frozen for revival after science has solved the problem of death? Or will your head alone suffice? Hughes also proposes equipping dolphins and monkeys with brain chips so that we can communicate with them. You would think that someone who entertains such thoughts would be a fun guy, and perhaps Hughes is in person. Come on, he's email him and tell him how fun I am. But anyway, Citizen Cyborg has the deadly earnestness of an Al Gore white paper on toxic waste. That's about the snarkiest thing anybody said about my book. Anyway, Hughes wants us to take this cyborg stuff very, very seriously. Those who find Hughes too dry may prefer the flamboyant, albeit relentlessly self-aggrandizing, authorial personality of Kevin Warwick, a professor of cybernetics at the University of Reading, who has transformed himself into a kind of neurobionic performance artist. In iCyborg, a masterpiece of naive, unwittingly comic narration. Sorry, I'm running out of juice in my throat here. A masterpiece of naive, unwittingly comic narration, Warwick recounts how in 2002, he persuaded a surgeon to implant a chip in his forearm and another chip in the forearm of his hapless wife, Irina. As the surgeon pushed the chip into Irina's incision, she remained brave, Warwick recalls, shrieking on a couple of occasions when it was particularly painful. After the implantations, when Warwick made a fist, his chip picked up the minute electrical surge in his arm and sent a signal to his wife's chip, which buzzed her. She then flexed her hand, and he felt a beautiful, sweet, deliciously sexy charge. Of course, the Warwicks could have achieved an equivalent intimacy with vibrating cell phones. The fact that the chips were embedded in their bodies made no functional difference. Warwick nonetheless calls this stunt the most incredible scientific project imaginable, one that is sure to change incalculably mankind and the future. Of course, many people share skepticism about Warwick's research. He goes on to talk about Ray Kurzweil, whose new book, Live Long Enough to Live Forever, Fantastic Voyage, and his shortly to be out book, The Singularity is Imminent, or something like that. The Singularity is Around the Corner. Ray Kurzweil is one of the leading exponents of this, and he talks about Rodney Brooks's book, Flesh and Machines, which is about the evolution of robotics. And then finally, he talks about a guy that he seems to like, Chorost, who wrote a book called Rebuilt, How Becoming Part Computer Made Me More Human. And he is a guy who got a cochlear implant and talks about what it was like to live with an artificial hearing aid implanted into his head. Artificial cochlea as being, in fact, a form of cyborgology. Okay, so that's John Horgan's piece found in the Chronicle of Higher Education 2 weeks ago. And I highly recommend it because it talks about me. And I think everyone should read about me, even if it's snarky things that people say. But what was I thought very funny was the day before John Horgan's piece came out. This was a piece in the BetterHumans.com. BetterHumans.com is an online magazine that chronicles and tracks all the trends in cyborgology and life extension medicine and the various kinds of transhuman endeavors that I like to track as well. And, you know, in the same day that Horgan is saying, the conclusion of Horgan's piece is, I felt my cognitive dissonance alarm clanging whenever I reminded myself of the issues that preoccupy most mature adults these days: terrorism, overpopulation, poverty, environmental degradation, AIDS, and other diseases, and all the pitfalls of ordinary life, which, parenthetically, I address in Citizen Cyborg. But anyway, I try to forget this veil of tears myself now and then by reading books like William Gibson's Neuromancer or watching movies like The Matrix. But I also try not to confuse science fiction with science. Okay, so his conclusion is all of us who are expecting a cyborg future are just living in science fiction and we're not paying attention to science. Well, the day before his piece comes out, this is a piece in Better Humans. A wireless chip has been developed for medical implants that would allow doctors to monitor a patient's health from miles away and even control the release of drugs such as insulin. Zarlink Semiconductor of Ottawa says the chip is the first designed specifically to link medical devices inside the body. In discussing the device, Steve Swift, general manager of Zarlink's ultra-low-power communications unit, pointed to the fact that baby boomers are getting older and being fitted with such devices as pacemakers and even brain stimulators. Zarlink says the chip can transmit 10 times the data of competing products while using 20% of the power. To save power, it enters sleep mode when it's not in use. The chip can communicate with a base station located about 2 meters away. Information can be sent over a phone or internet to a physician. Doctors will be able to use the chip to do such things as adjust pacemakers and eventually such drug dispensing devices as implanted insulin pumps. I have a friend in England, by the way, Peter Houghton, who has an artificial heart, and the power cord goes up through his carotid artery out the side of his skull and into a bag at his side. And when he turns the knob on the battery in the bag at his side, it turns up and down his heart rate. And sometimes that's a problem because he once had his bag snatched and he fell over. Unfortunately, they got the bag back and plugged him back in. But at any rate, these things are not that far away. Finally, another favorite theme on Change Surfer Radio, and again this week in Better Humans. This is an article from Better Humans. Experimental pill boosts smarts. The drug CX717 works by increasing levels of the chemical glutamate, which is involved in learning and remembering. Part of a group of compounds called ampakines, the drug has demonstrated in UK tests on 16 sleep-deprived volunteers that it can improve wakefulness and mental ability. CX717 is being considered by manufacturer Cortex for treating narcolepsy and attention deficit disorder. The drug's creator, Gary Lynch, told New Scientist magazine that the drug could also be used to treat jet lag and possibly even diseases like Alzheimer's. So this is a new set of compounds that do the same thing as Provigil, which is a drug that was originally developed to treat narcolepsy, to keep people awake when they were trying to fall, when their brains kept making them fall asleep. Provigil turns out that you can, if you get it, you now prescribe for you, if you're a shift worker who have to work overnight, it can keep you working and awake for like 36 hours without any decrement in your performance. And also it has none of the side effects of amphetamines. It doesn't make you jittery. It doesn't make you paranoid and so on and so forth. And so here's another set of compounds doing the same thing as Provigil. And also, like Provigil, may be a treatment for hyperactivity disorder, which 5 to 10% of American kids can benefit from stimulant medication, and probably even more could benefit from non-stimulant treatments for attention deficit disorder, and as well as adults who have attention deficit disorder. So we are on the road to a cyborg future. Those who refuse to see what's coming are like... like hunter-gatherers who refuse to acknowledge the importance of agriculture or something. Anyway, this has been Change Surfer Radio. Check back next week. We will have a guest next week. Can't tell you who it is yet. It's a secret. Talk to you then. You've been listening to Change Surfer Radio. Change Surfer Radio is produced at WHUS Stores at the University of Connecticut. If you want to learn more about democratic transhumanism, or you want to share your thoughts with me, Dr. J, you can contact me at jhughes@changesurfer.com. That's jhughes@changesurfer.com. Or you can read my Change Surfing columns at betterhumans.com or check out the collaborative Cyborg Democracy blog I participate in at cyborgdemocracy.net. Or you can read my new book, Citizen Cyborg. For more details about Citizen Cyborg, visit cyborgdemocracy.net. At the Change Surfer website, you can find past and future shows archived in streaming MP3, thanks to the AInfos radio project. So educate, agitate, and organize, and I hope to meet you in a sexy high-tech and yet radically democratic future.